From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Today in Baghdad, former dictator Saddam Hussein spent his first day in the dock, on trial, before the Iraqi people and the world. For Iraqis who suffered under his rule, this was day one toward justice. For Saddam supporters, it's a show trial. For all the world, it's high drama. Until 2.5 years ago, Saddam was a chilling tyrant with a genius for terrorizing and slaughtering his own people and tweaking the world's superpowers. Now he's on trial, far from power, but still combative. Today, presiding judge Risgar Mohammed Amin ordered the defendant to state his name.
Mr. Saddam. We are here to ascertain your identity. You will have enough time to say whatever you like and to express your thought. This is the Iraqi Criminal Court, a special court, and you're here to be tried.
But Saddam Hussein refused to answer and instead demanded to know the judge's name and by what authority he was putting the president of Iraq on trial.
You know me. You are Iraqi. And you know me. I have no hatred towards anybody of you. However, out of my determination for right and in respect to the glorious Iraqi people, I would like to say that I refuse to answer these questions.
Saddam Hussein faces many days of trial, but from day one it is clear his strategy is to put the trial itself on trial. And Iraq, the region, and the world are watching. This hour on Point, the trial of Saddam, day one and beyond. We begin in Baghdad with Dan Murphy, Middle East correspondent for the Christian Science Monitor. He's one of the few journalists who was allowed to sit in the courtroom and observe the proceedings today. Dan, thanks for being with us.
My pleasure. How are you?
We're very well. Can you set the scene for us, Dan? Where is this exactly in the green zone? What's the building around the chamber? What's the chamber itself look like?
Working through those questions, this is in the heart of the green zone. It is the former Ba'ath Party headquarters, certainly a building Saddam would have been very familiar with, though he probably didn't know he was going there until this morning or last night whenever they moved him. For journalists to get in there today, we went through 7 to 8 separate security screenings, including getting retina scans yesterday, including going through 2 high-tech walk-through sonic imaging machines that could see everything on one's body, including not being able to take our own pencils and pads into the room from where we eventually observed the trial, which was the back of the courtroom. But it was soundproofed and walled off from the proceedings with bulletproof glass. The courtroom itself is quite small. You have the 8 defendants in there. You had about 4 or 5 prosecutors, 4 judges, or 5 judges, I should say, their clerks, and about 15 defense lawyers, and it really couldn't hold many more than that. And it had the scales of justice on the back wall. And otherwise, you know, was in an old Saddam-style palace at the heart of the Green Zone.
Now, what we saw, Dan, the images that we saw had the defendants in sort of a cubicle height cages or bars. What's the physical setup with the defendants?
That's right. They're in. They are brought in and they sit in the dock in the center of the courtroom. With that, you know, 2.5 foot high metal fence around it. That's common in Iraqi courts, and indeed in Arab courts, some kind of cage, either symbolic or sort of open like that, is very common. In Egypt, for instance, they actually put the defendants in a 10 foot high cage. So that's not unusual. And then they sit there and confront the judges. Remember, this isn't an American style court. It's not quite an adversarial system. So a lot of the question and a lot of the running of the tempo of the proceedings will be by the judges themselves.
Now, you said 8 defendants. Remind us, generally, who are the other defendants in the chamber with Saddam Hussein?
All of these men are on trial for the Dujail massacre. There was an attempt on Saddam's life in this town about 50 miles north of Baghdad. It's a mostly Shiite town in 1982. He survived. He then turned around and essentially ordered about 150 members of the town killed, its fields salted so that they couldn't be farmed anymore, and its trees destroyed. And so everybody in this is involved. Was involved in this atrocity. Everything from a local Ba'ath Party official who you know, describes himself as a farmer, although he's quite well-to-do, to, you know, Taha Yassin Ramadan, who was Saddam Hussein's vice president, you know, as well as Barzan Hassan al-Tikriti, who was his longtime head of intelligence. So it's kind of a mixed bag of people in there, but the thread that ties them together was their involvement in this specific atrocity that prosecutors think is easy to prove, so they started with this one.
Dan, describe Saddam Hussein for us. We've just had glimpses of him since he was pulled out of this infamous spider hole, pretty bedraggled. Now and then, public appearances, the infamous then, you know, underwear pictures that were published of him in incarceration. How did he carry himself? What was his body language, and what did he have to say today in the courtroom?
Well, you know, he looks very good. He's much trimmer than he was when he was president of the country. He was very, you know, trying to be presidential. When the guards tried to usher him out of the courtroom when this thing ended today, you know, he shrugged them off and got into a confrontation with them and got his way. He got to walk out without their hands on his arms. He is clearly not going to participate or avoid participating in this trial as much as possible. He sees the whole thing as illegitimate. He declared more than once that he's still the president of Iraq and the whole process is invalid and unconstitutional. You know, and that's the way he's going to go down. This is certainly not a beaten man by anything that we can see from his body language or the things that he says.
Then, Dan, you've spent months and months reporting there outside the courtroom. Now you come in today. Iraqis, along with the rest of the world, will be watching this video. How do you think it's going to hit the Iraqi public at large? Does it look like a scene of justice, a scene of what? You name it.
I think to most Iraqis it will, although there's a lot of frustration. You know, if you talk to, you know, the average Shiite in Baghdad or anywhere else in the country, they want him dead by now, and they'll come up with very creative ways that they want him made dead. There are some Sunni Arabs and even some Christians who yearn for the days of stability under Saddam and have some sympathy. But by and large, the political reality here is I think people are going to respond quite well to this trial as long as it produces the result that they're demanding.
And Saddam himself, you say, much fitter than we saw him in the past, a broken man or still reserves of feistiness, of combativeness there?
Oh, I think he's incredibly feisty. You know, the first 5 or 6 minutes of the trial involved him refusing to answer the question about what his name was from the judge. You know, and then he turns around to the guy and he says, "You know who I am. I don't have to tell you that." And then he says, "Who are you?" Now, you know, I think the old Saddam, that's calculated to terrify someone when he's interested in knowing what your name is. You know, this is not a cowed man. And I think he was scared the first time he went to the courtroom because he maybe suspected that summary justice was going to be meted out. But once he figured out that wasn't going to happen, I think he's relaxed.
And now adjourned to November 28th, Dan Murphy, who was in the courtroom in the chamber today observing with a small group of journalists. They were very grateful to you for being with us. Thank you for joining us from Baghdad.
Thanks for having me.
Dan Murphy, Middle East correspondent for the Christian Science Monitor. I want to turn now to Cleveland, Ohio, where we're joined by Michael Scharf, professor of law and director of the Frederick K. Cox International Law Center at Case Western Reserve University. He's a member of the international team that trained the prosecutors and judges of the Iraqi Special Tribunal, which was sitting today. He assisted in the prosecution of Serbian leader Slobodan Milosevic and Liberia's Charles Taylor. He's author of several books, including Peace with Justice. Michael Scharf, thanks for being with us.
Hi, Tom. It's good to be on.
There's a lot we want to learn from you. We've heard you talking about this trial in anticipation. Now we've actually watched a day of it. Your first reaction, first just to the scene there, you watched like the rest of the world on this 20-minute delay video, time enough for them to cut things out if they feel it's not going well for them, I guess, in propaganda terms. But just your first reaction to what you saw today in Baghdad.
I think in a phrase, we saw a defiant ex-dictator opposing a patient but firm Judge Amin. And I think this was a very good first step for the trial of Saddam Hussein.
And strategies? Can you see what's emerging in the prosecution and defense already in the first day? Is it apparent or not?
Well, what's interesting is Saddam Hussein, although he's defiant and says he doesn't recognize this court, unlike Slobodan Milosevic, he is more willing to play by the rules. After a few minutes of this trial, he behaved himself quite well, as did the other defendants that are next to him.
So his behavior looks cooperative, even if he didn't answer everything. But was there enough put on the table today that you can tell where his defense team is headed?
Oh, I think we know exactly where they're headed. They have three prongs of attack, and they all came out in his first statements. The first prong is that the court is illegitimate. The second argument is that he is the president, and under the 1968 Constitution, he has immunity and cannot be tried. And the third prong is everything that happened in Al-Dajjal was perfectly legitimate for a leader to do when he is subject to an assassination attempt and there's a town full of terrorists and insurgents.
And the prosecution's strategy or response, is it does it dance with those at all, or does it ignore those and go on its own agenda?
Well, we didn't actually see the prosecutor's opening statement, but the prosecutor did read a more detailed bit about what the charges are and some of the facts that support those charges. And the most interesting thing that came out of that is that the prosecutor said that they have a document that they will introduce into court that shows that Saddam Hussein signed, sealed, and delivered the death warrant for the people who were killed in Dajjal. And that seems like a smoking gun if I've ever heard of one.
But this is just one of a dozen or more trials that could hypothetically take place. Is that right, Michael Sharp?
Right. There are at least 12 other charges, and they are all greater than the case about Dajjal. They are things like the Anfal campaign that killed hundreds of thousands of northern Kurds and the attacks on the southern Marsh Arabs. But they're going to start with this trial because they were ready to go and their evidence is strongest at this point. And they will not give the death penalty. That's a misconception. They won't execute him at the end of this trial, even if they find that that verdict is the correct verdict, because they want him to be alive to stand on the other charges.
Maybe a verdict of death, but it won't be executed right away. And so it begins, the trial of Saddam Hussein, underway today in Baghdad. What do you think? 1-800-423-8255. Is this justice? I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about the trial of Saddam Hussein, underway today in Baghdad. Here is Saddam Hussein in the dock, challenging the legitimacy of the court he faces.
This court is not legal, and I reserve my constitutional right not to proceed. One of the negative aspects of this court is that I don't recognize the party that has appointed you or entrusted you. I don't recognize the aggression against our country because it was based on injustice and on wrongdoing.
Saddam Hussein, defiant there in the dock in Baghdad today, day one of his trial. People have been waiting a long time. You can join this conversation. What are you thinking as you see and hear Saddam Hussein go to trial? Is this like Nuremberg, the trial of Milosevic? And what kind of justice do you expect out of this courtroom in Baghdad? Cosmic justice for all the death and suffering? Victor's justice that leaves out the fingerprints of the world, of the U.S.? Will this trial help Iraq heal? Will it help end the war or not? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. We're joined from Cleveland by Michael Scharf. He helped train the international team of prosecutors and judges in the Iraqi Special Tribunal. He's at Case Western Reserve University Law School. We're also joined from New York by George Packer, staff writer for the New Yorker magazine and author of The Assassin's Gate, America in Iraq. George Packer, thank you for joining us today.
My pleasure.
Your thoughts, your reaction as you watch the trial get into gear in Baghdad?
Well, it's always riveting to see Saddam, and I deeply envy Dan Murphy for having been in the same room with him. It's a privilege for a journalist to be able to do that, and it sounds like a very difficult one to obtain. To back up from today's events a bit, every trial of this nature is in some way political. We think of justice as being cut off from its context, and for it to be true justice, it has to be, in a sense, sterilized and pure, if mm-hmm. not in an underground bunker. But every trial like this is a political one in some way, and politically necessary. And it's always politically and morally necessary for countries like Iraq that have gone through the kind of horrors that they've gone through to see this through. My worry about this trial happening now is that this political context is so unstable and unresolved, and in a sense, Saddam has not yet been defeated. His people speaking in his name or in the name of his ideology are continuing to carry on a war that's actually getting worse by the week. In answer to the question you asked just a minute ago, I don't think it's going to have that effect of healing wounds. It's necessary, especially for his victims, who are, you know, the vast majority of Iraqis, to see it happen. But it may well be that even some of his Sunni Arab victims will begin to rally to his side, because the trial is bound to become a symbol of their sense of marginalization and victimization, which has grown pretty severe over the last 2.5 years.
No kidding. And we see it every day in the insurgency. We want to explore that a lot more. But Michael Scharf, how do you respond to that? I mean, George Packer points out what's clear here. You can't have a trial of this nature without it being political in some part. I mean, you have a man on trial, but he was, by whatever means, the head of state. And so his power was interwoven with state power. State power is often deadly. His was outrageously deadly. How do you ultimately decide if justice has been done here? What does justice need to look like in this case?
Well, I can tell you that the case is ultimately going to be messy. And like any trial of this magnitude, there are going to be mistakes. There are going to be errors and missteps. Ultimately, the question of justice comes down to whether there was a miscarriage of justice or whether they were able to fairly decide the case. And usually you look at three things. First, you look to see if the procedures are true and fair. And in this case, they've imported the international procedures from the Yugoslavia Tribunal and the Rwanda Tribunal, which are the highest procedures of due process known in the world. And they're giving these to Saddam Hussein. Secondly, you look to see whether there is equality of arms. And as you heard at the top of the hour from Dan, there are 15 defense lawyers in the courtroom. They are aided by another 100 or more of some of the best superstar lawyers in the world who have joined this defense team.
Saddam Hussein's defense team?
Yes.
Superstar lawyers like whom? Who's out there signing up for that duty?
Well, you've got Ramsey Clark, the former Attorney General of the United States, who previously helped defend Slobodan Milosevic, so he has a lot of experience with war crimes trials. You've got people like Jacques Vergès, who defended Barbie, the Nazi who was tried in France. And you've got people from every part of the globe who are coming out because they see this as the trial of the century and they want a piece of the action.
Mm-hmm.
The third thing that fairness requires is that the judges be fair. And here I think it is so great that they picked as their presiding judge Rizgad Mohamed Amin, because he is the picture of fairness. He's a Kurd and not a Shiite, and these, of course, were crimes against Shiites, so that makes him one step removed. I found him during the training sessions.
That being in Dujail against Shiites, but of course exactly. It'll come around to the Kurdish question here in time.
But he is only presiding over this particular case, and there are other judges who will take the lead in the other cases. I found him during the training sessions to be both sharp as a whip, but also very even-keeled in his personality. He has a wonderful sense of humor, and already you saw during the trial that he was able to smile at Saddam Hussein and disarm him in that way. Many people who are lawyers in Iraq are very aggressive. They're natural litigators. And this Judge Amin has a rare temperament that he is so soothing. And he's just perfect to show, you know, what the picture of due process ought to be. And it's important not just for this case, but when they resurrect the rest of the Iraqi court system and they start to add due process for those trials, they'll be looking at this as a model. And this, I think, first day bodes well for that.
Human Rights Watch, as you of course know, said just a few days ago that this puts the image of fair trials at risk, that it may not be seen to be a fair trial and therefore do damage to the whole idea of a trial like this. Well, you've kind of got an iron in this fire, we know, Michael Scharf. You worked with these judges, but what do you say to that complaint?
Well, you know, usually I'm on the same side of the boat with Human Rights Watch. I'm personally a very big advocate of international tribunals, and that's where they're coming for. But for me, the broader and more important thing is accountability and the end of the age of impunity. And I feel that Human Rights Watch is missing the boat a little bit here. The kinds of criticisms that they're making are not really very well educated. And I'll give you an example. In the newspapers yesterday, you heard Ken Roth from Human Rights Watch say that they're not using the beyond reasonable doubt standard in this trial, and that in itself means it's unfair. Now, obviously, that statement, to me, reflects that he doesn't understand the civil law system, which is employed in most of the countries in the world, including France, most of the continent of Europe, and in Iraq, where they don't have the words beyond reasonable doubt. What they do instead is they presume innocence, and they have to prove guilt to the sufficient determination of the judges. And when I asked the judges in the Iraqi Special Tribunal what that meant to them, they said that guilt had to be proved to a certainty. And you know what? That's actually a higher standard than we have for reasonable doubt in the United States.
Proved to these judges, of course, critics will say, well, they were trained up by you, trained up by the United States. And yet there is a standard, certainty, that's laid down there. George Packer, I want to come back to you on that point in just a moment. But first, if I may, I want to turn to Baghdad. We're joined from Iraq by Hunain Kado, a member of the Iraqi parliament, watching along with Iraqis and the world today as Saddam Hussein went on trial. He's also chairman of the Iraq Minorities Council. Hunain Kado, thank you for being with us. What did you think of the trial today, day one?
Thank you very much. Thank you for having this opportunity to talk to you about Saddam's trial. Well, I think really, I mean, this is a new experience for the Iraqi people. As some of your guests mentioned, this is going to be a model for Iraqi court system in the future. Saddam Hussein, I'm sure, is going to have a fair trial, a just trial, and he should be really tried on the crimes he committed against the Iraqi people. He committed crimes against all minorities, against Iraqi people, against Shiites, and against Kurds, and also against Sunnis. So we have to really establish a new tradition, new culture, a new political system, a new court system in Iraq. So I think it is high time really to get rid of Saddam and his regime.
Do you think that a majority of Iraqis will see this trial as fair? It's only the first day we know. There's much yet to be seen. But does the structure look fair?
Well, definitely a lot of Iraqis, the majority of Iraqis, will think that this trial is fair because they know Saddam Hussein very well. I mean, Saddam Hussein killed around 2 million Iraqi people, sent a lot of Iraqis to war fronts, and destroyed Iraqi economy. So definitely economy. So definitely majority of Iraqi will support the trial, and they will think that Saddam Hussein probably had a very good chance, and he's lucky because he is now on the trial, and he's free to talk in comparison with his court system in old regime. I mean, when a person would really hang and within a few minutes.
And Hunain Kado, finally, what about the insurgency in Iraq and the insurgents who are presumably also watching on television today? They're seeing Saddam Hussein. He does not come across as a defeated man. Do you think that the insurgency will be further provoked by this trial? Might it deepen and worsen the insurgency, or might ultimately it bring insurgents, Sunnis, around to accepting a new order?
I think in short time it will really deteriorate the situation in Iraq, and it will probably evoke the insurgency in Iraq. And Saddam Hussein really was a symbol for a lot of Baathists, and also a symbol of some of the Iraqis really who admired him, who really has lost their interest because of Saddam's removal from the power. So that will really deepen the verge between the Iraqi people.
Hunain Kado, parliament member in Iraq, joining us from Baghdad. Thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you very much, sir.
George Packer, the trial opening up today in Ba'ath Party headquarters, of all places, a kind of a poke in the eye, the irony certainly not lost on Saddam and his fellow defendants today. How do you see this affecting the political climate, the insurgency in Iraq?
I agree with Mr. Kado that it's going to sharpen divides, at least in the short term. Seeing Saddam in court today reminded me of his very first appearance in the summer of 2004 before a different judge, a young judge named Raed Juhi, whom I interviewed a couple of times and with whom I was extremely impressed. And I had a discussion that night with my translator, who's mixed Sunni and Shiite, about this judge. And I said, this judge should be regarded as a national hero. He's exactly the kind of Iraqi whom Iraqis should admire and see as a model for the future. And my translator, who is no friend of the insurgency at all, said to me, it's too soon for us to feel that way about him. We still see him as someone who was put there by the Americans, by the occupation. He's not his own man. He's too young. He's too much their tool. And if it sort of woke me up at that moment to the sense that my idea of justice and of what Iraq needed at that moment, that is for Saddam to be tried by a fair process and certainly convicted, was complicated by my translator's feeling that the political context is not right, that people like him are not going to buy into this, even if every I is dotted and T is crossed, as Mr. Scharf suggested. So there's this larger context that every trial like this takes place in. In this case, unlike in The Hague, unlike Arusha, unlike Nuremberg, the war is not over, and that's the big difference.
The war's not over, and a very large foreign army is still right there. Let's get a call. Claire's calling from Nashville. Hi, Claire, you're on the air.
Hi.
Hi, what do you think, Claire? What do you see?
Well, you know, I was in northern Iraq this summer doing a documentary on the Kurds, and I met family after family after family, and I didn't meet one that did not have some family member who had been either imprisoned or tortured or killed by Saddam. So on a cosmic level, I think for the Kurds to feel a part of Iraq, at least, this is an important step, and especially with the further trials. And I think it is important that the Iraqi people are seen as the ones who are, you know, sort of mending themselves or addressing these wrongs. And I realize it's not perfect. Certainly the U.S. is there, but I at this point it seems to me that at least it appears that they will be, to some degree, helping to redress the wrongs that were done in their own country.
And you were there. You felt the pain of the Kurds, and of course they had plenty of it. Claire, thanks very much for calling in from Nashville. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. Michael Scharf, how about it? Claire uses the phrase, the Iraqis themselves working to heal here. Will it be seen that way? The United States has had a large role in this, in helping set up this court, in supporting the court. Will it be seen as Iraqi justice or American justice?
Well, you know, unfortunately, I think it's going to largely be seen as American justice. And even the question, the way you described my involvement before, shows that people have bought off on this. I'm not a supporter or a fan of the Bush administration. I was brought in to help train the judges as an independent voice, and they didn't tell me what I could and couldn't say about it.
Fair enough. I was just pointing out you were complimenting the judges that you yourself helped train. So I just wanted to make clear that there's a relationship there.
But what I want to say is I'll also be very critical, as I have been of other judges that I've trained in Yugoslavia and Rwanda, when they deserve it, as a way of helping to push the process forward. Now, the big question that George asks and that Claire also talks about is, you know, the role that these trials can have in healing a country. And George says it'll actually increase the divide. You know, it's all goes back to a myth of Nuremberg. After Nuremberg, everybody said, oh, look, the German people were educated about the Nazi atrocities, and it allowed them to discredit the leaders and to rejoin the West. And that's not actually what happened. After Nuremberg, the State Department took opinion polls throughout Germany every year for 10 years. And every year the opinion polls showed that the majority, the overwhelming majority, up to 85% of Germans felt that Göring and the other defendants were not guilty and that the Nuremberg trial was actually unfair. And it wasn't until two or three generations after that that the German people changed their mind. And I think what this tells us is that trials, international war crimes trials, don't actually empirically have an immediate positive effect on a population. The people who think that Saddam is guilty are going to continue to think that and think the trial is great. The ones who are supporting Saddam, as George points out, are going to think the trial is unfair. And it will take maybe a generation before the historic record built through this trial actually seeps into the Iraqi consciousness.
A generation is a long time, especially as an insurgency goes on. You say international trial, but then it's also described as Iraqi trial. Which is it?
Well, it's actually an internationalized domestic tribunal. It's a hybrid. And the reason I say that is because it's using the Iraqi judges and the Iraqi prosecutors, and it's in Baghdad, but it's using international crimes from the statutes of the Yugoslavia Tribunal and the Rwanda Tribunal, and it's also, most interestingly, layering the international standards of due process on top of the criminal code of Iraq, and to the extent there's any conflict, the statute says the international standards prevail.
Michael Scharf, stand by. George Packer, we want to come back and talk about American vulnerability, potentially, in this court on the foreign policy front. Listeners, you can join us, 1-800-423-8255. We're talking about day one of the trial of Saddam Hussein. This is On Point.
Support for On Point comes from the listeners of WBUR Boston, Bicon Dental Implants, offering short implants that can eliminate the need for bone grafting. Information is available at Bicon.com, B-I-C-O-N.com, and Private Wealth Management at Babson Capital. For more than 60 years, helping clients build and preserve wealth through financial planning, investment management, and trust services. In Cambridge and on the web at BabsonCapital.com.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about the trial of Saddam Hussein, day one, today in Baghdad. It is underway. You can join us. Did you lose a son or daughter to Saddam? Is justice finally coming in this courtroom? Is this a best effort at justice or a show trial or both? And I guess this, when a tyrant is toppled, is there any kind of justice but victor's justice? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Joined by New Yorker magazine writer George Packer, author of the new book, The Assassin's Gate, America in Iraq. And from Cleveland, Ohio, by Michael Scharf, professor at Case Western Reserve University Law School, been very active in training the team of judges that will be at work with Saddam Hussein. Right now, Vahal is calling from Washington, D.C. Vahal, you're on the air.
Hi, yeah, thanks for taking my call. I'm calling from the Iraq Memory Foundation. The point I want to make is about Saddam's image, the way he may be viewed since Saddam's capture. He may come off as a defeated man, the images of him as a bearded man and images in his underwear or reporting that he likes to eat Doritos in jail and does not like Cheerios might have trivialized the bigger picture or lessened the significance of this man. The fact is, not only does he continue to be exceedingly arrogant, by, for example, refusing to identify himself this morning to Judge Rezgar, but also the people of Iraq, we the people of Iraq, Saddam's victims, continue to view him as a Stalin-like figure, a fearful man.
A fearsome guy. The Iraq Memory Foundation focused on not forgetting all the people who died under his regime. Are you confident that justice will be done? Do you expect Saddam Hussein will be dead at the end of this?
Well, I don't want to make any predictions now. It's only the first session. I'm confident that the court, the special tribunal, meets international standards, and we've worked with this particular court. We've worked with the investigators. We've provided them with documents, and I guess we'll have to see.
But don't forget, this was not a man standing in his underwear with Doritos. This was a powerful dictator, and his legacy is pretty well known on that front. Vahal, thank you for your call. I want to turn quickly once more to Baghdad right now for a sense of how Iraqis more widely are responding to today's opening day of the trial. Borzu Daragahi joins us from Baghdad. He's Baghdad correspondent for the Los Angeles Times. He spent the day in the streets of Baghdad watching Iraqis watch Saddam. Borzu Daragahi, thanks for being with us. What kind of response did you hear to what people are seeing of this trial?
Well, we went to several different places in Baghdad, and we also dispatched correspondents in other parts of the country to check in with people in general. What I found was just what I had sort of expected to find. Ordinary Iraqi people, view the trial mostly through a sectarian prism. That is, if they are Sunni Arabs or diehard nationalists, they viewed the trial as a humiliating event brought about by occupiers. And if they are Shiites or Kurds, they saw it as a triumph, as a chance to redress some of the injustices that were inflicted upon their community over the decades.
So straight down along sectarian lines, I mean, that's predictable, I suppose, but kind of distressing at the same time. What's your gut telling you, Borzu? Do you think this is going to bring ultimately some kind of closure for Iraq or be more fuel for the fire of the insurgency?
Well, I mean, you know, some of the Iraqis that I talked to said, you know, wouldn't it have been more sensible not to have this trial at the time of the apex, really, of sectarian tensions in Iraq? Wouldn't it have been more sensible to do this after the elections, maybe, when a more permanent, stable government was in place and the Sunni Arabs had more of a voice? The Sunni Arabs, as listeners must know, are the group that's leading the insurgency. And that's the sense that I got from some people. But on the other hand, there's a lot of people in Iraq who suffered unbelievably nightmarish grievances because of Saddam Hussein. I was talking to one family, and the story they were telling me was just heartbreaking. You know, basically they were a family of 13, and over the years they were whittled down to two, just a brother and a sister,
wow,
who for weeks now had been planning to come together today to watch the trial.
Borzu, I know power is intermittent there sometimes, and not everyone is in a position, but is everybody watching this, quote-unquote, in Iraq, in Baghdad today? Was everyone glued to the television screen, if they could be?
It seemed like at one point today, there was a point when everyone was glued to the television screen, where people took off work today to watch this on television. On the other hand, there are many, many problems in Iraq, as listeners know. And, you know, for example, you know, I don't know, but like in the evening when most people usually, it's Ramadan now, most people go to break the fast with their families at home, I saw huge lines of people waiting in line for gas. I was talking to somebody, they said they'd been waiting for 3 hours and they were going to miss the meal with their family because they were forced to wait for gas. So those sorts of everyday concerns sometimes overpower the more important things in life.
And when Saddam comes on the screen, he was such an icon of power and fear. What's the reaction? Do people suck in their breath? Are they expressing disdain when they see him? Are they expressing fear when they see him? What were people? How were they commenting on Saddam Hussein himself as he appeared in the court today?
You know, it's remarkable what a long shadow he still casts on the Iraqi people. The reactions were very emotional. The reactions were very strong and stark. People felt fear. I spoke to one woman who was saying, my God, I can't believe it. He still scares me. Just seeing him still scares me. There was one point where he refused to give his name, and I heard one of the people that I was watching that segment with just sort of disdainfully said, look at that. He's a madman. He's crazy. He's insane. The judge is saying one thing, and he's answering something else. You know, so there was a real strong elements of disdain and fear.
But still a long shadow. He may be on trial, but he's alive, and they see him standing. Borzu Dargahi, you describe it well, and we're grateful to you for being with us. Thank you for joining us.
It's been a pleasure. Thank you.
Borzu Dargahi, Baghdad correspondent for the L.A. Times. Let's get a call. Siddiqui's calling from Roxbury, Massachusetts. Hi, Siddiqui. You're on the air.
Yes, sir. I was just calling in to say, essentially, that it appears that this whole trial of Saddam is nothing more but a continuation of a charade being perpetrated by the United States to give the appearances of some normalcy in Iraq, you know, such as the constitutional process and the president saying, well, it shows that the Iraqis want democracy when they had 60% participate, when the reality is that the Sunnis were told by Sistani to vote for it, not the Sunnis, but the
Shia. Yeah, but how can you say charade, Siddiqui? I mean, the man, we know many people died under his regime. He certainly has some responsibility for that. Now he's on trial. Where's the charade?
Well, the charade is that, you know, is this premature? As I heard someone state, why do it now? And what I'm saying is that the United States, which is orchestrating this whole process, is saying we need to promote this image that there's a normalcy here. Here's a country without electricity, water. They've got an army that functions like F troop and a judicial system that looks like the former Shogun on night court. Yet they're trying to say that they're prepared in terms of the judiciary to be able to trial Saddam.
So normalcy has arrived is the message, but you're not buying it. Siddiqui, thanks for your call. George Packer, how about it? I think I've read the United States didn't want to go ahead so quickly with this, but Iraqis themselves, who were in a position to push, pushed.
Yeah, I think the real push, and in a way it's also somewhat disturbing, is coming from whatever Iraqi party happens to be in power. When Ayad Alawi was prime minister, he tried to rush the trial. There was a lot of a flurry of reports last winter that it was going to happen before the January elections. Of course, it didn't. And now Prime Minister Jafari and President Talabani have been weighing in, and these are not helpful interventions because they sort of affirm what Borzu said earlier, that this is a sectarian, you know, in the eyes of some Iraqis, this is being driven by sectarian passions rather than by pure justice. But I also wanted to say the tragedy of this trial is that it's become a part of the tragedy of the whole enterprise, which is to say, here we have obviously morality and justice so clearly on one side in this, and yet the world is divided. Human Rights Watch and the International Center for Transitional Justice are weighing in against this, and it simply repeats the divisions that the war itself brought about in the international community, where you had NGOs and foreign governments that ordinarily would be right on the scene of the kind of intervention that the Bush administration said this was, trying to stand in the way. And the trial has become a part of that, with America and the Iraqi government on one side and so many Sunni Arab countries, European countries, and NGOs on the other side. And to me, that's a tragedy.
And you think they're on the other side because...
There should be no
question here. But you think they're on the other side because, I mean, the European Union is opposed to the death penalty, so that's part of what has put it there. Are they on the other side because of resentment about the U.S. invasion and occupation, because they don't like the details of how the trial is going to proceed? Are they siding with Saddam?
I certainly don't think that European powers and European lawyers are siding with Saddam, but I do know that a lot of them refuse to participate in the training and the pre-trial process that Mr. Sharp was a part of, simply because they saw it as an American project. I know some foreign lawyers and judges did participate, but there was real division, and there is a strong perception that this was paid for and trained by Americans. Again, there's nothing on the face of it that's wrong with that. The Iraqis don't have the money to do this. Of course someone had to pay for it. But what I'm saying is, politically, it simply deepens the divisions both within Iraq and around the world that have been there all along.
Even with a figure of such oppression as Saddam Hussein, things really do get polarized. Kathy's calling from Marlboro, Massachusetts. Hi, Kathy. You're on the air.
Hello. My comment is that I go back to what your guest said about the Nuremberg trials, and that being proof that the national consciousness was still pro-Hitler after...
It took a generation for that kind of lessons of Nuremberg,
yes,
quote-unquote, to sink in.
I don't agree with that. I don't think that in the case of Iraq, any more than in the case of Stalin, I think if the people of Iraq watch this trial go on, that they will feel validated and they will feel vindicated. And I don't think it's going to take a generation to do that, because it's just not the same.
What gives you that confidence, Kathy?
Hitler, because you can't compare. I'm just going with his comparison.
Mm-hmm.
You can't. For Hitler's regime did not affect the German people as a whole the way Saddam's regime has affected Iraqi people.
Well, I don't know about that. I mean, he took Germany down into a pretty deep hole before it was over. You know, cripples and kids being sent to war, and the country ended up in quite disastrous situation. Yet, I take your point that you're not sure it will take so long for this to sink in. We'll look at that. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. Michael Scharf, George Packer describes his international community sitting kind of on the bench in part here, not willing to join in even with the figure of the sort of terrifying reputation of Saddam Hussein. You've been in the middle of this. What does that leave you feeling, thinking? How does it surprise you?
Well, I think you're right that the main reasons were, one, the death penalty, which is something that the Iraqis insisted on, not the United States, and second, the resentment of the United States invasion without getting Security Council authorization. But I do want to correct something that George said. During our training sessions, the judges of the Yugoslavia Tribunal were invited to London to join us, and every one of them got a ticket and was ready to come, and the UN Secretary General forbade them from coming.
This is to train the Iraqi judges who are at work today.
Yeah, and so what I have found is that most people who are experts in international humanitarian law realize that the big picture here is accountability, that this is the trial of Saddam Hussein, and they wanted to be part to make it the best trial possible.
Why didn't the UN want them there? Why not? What do you have against it?
Again, it was because at the same time the Secretary General was writing statements that were part of his report saying that the invasion was unlawful and taking issue with the death penalty. Those are the two issues that have divided the international community. But when it gets down to the details of the trial, everybody who's looked carefully at this say, hey, you know, they did a pretty good job. I also want to return to something Sadaki was saying about this being a charade. Actually, it's true to a certain point that they are purposely trying to employ symbolism and that this is all being very well choreographed in order to try to attain the result of reconciliation, which I say is based on a myth. For example, when they asked Saddam Hussein in the courtroom today to show his ID papers and say his name and position, and he said, well, everyone in Iraq knows who I am, what they were trying to do is deflate him and show this is an ordinary court proceeding and he is no better than any other defendant. And even the seating positions are very important. Right next to Saddam Hussein, the guy he's joking with during the recesses, is a guy named Judge Awad Abandar. And he was in charge of the Revolutionary Courts that signed the execution order in 1982 for the 150 deaths in Al-Dajjal. What they're trying to do is not just put Saddam on trial, but try the revolutionary court system as well. And this is an awful lot like that movie Judgment at Nuremberg, which was based on the Ostetler case, where Judy Garland and Spencer Tracy and Marlene Dietrich were in this movie where they were prosecuting the judges of Nuremberg who had perverted justice. And this is an important lesson for the new Iraqi court system, and that is that justice means justice, and you can get in trouble, even be prosecuted, if you pervert it.
George Packer, yes, please speak to that. And also this, George, because we've just got a couple of minutes here. We're told Saddam's defense hopes to put the United States on trial and the history of U.S. foreign policy and call Bill Clinton, George H.W. Bush, even George W. Bush, or try to call them to the stand. Do you see the U.S. as vulnerable on that front here in whatever terms?
Well, they're bound to do that. I mean, that's inevitable. Milosevic has tried to do the same thing. It's you know, in a sense, Saddam's only recourse in because of his own record. But I just want to go back to Nuremberg. It's true that trials are show trials in the sense that they are showing justice being done. They are symbolic. Mr. Sharp is absolutely right. And perhaps in a generation, Iraqis will look back on this and say, you know, we were divided then, but now we see that it was important that this be done. But there are far too many analogies to post-war Germany floating around, because the obvious key difference is, in that case, the Nazi Party was absolutely defeated. German society was prostrate, and there was international legitimacy in the occupation, whereas the problem now is there's a war going on right outside that courtroom, which is why Dan Murphy had to go through all those checks in order to get inside. Mm-hmm. And this is going to have an effect on that war. It can't be cut off from it. And that makes it so profoundly different from every other war crimes trial that we've seen over the past decade and the Nuremberg trials. This has not been resolved in any way, let alone in the court.
And the trial goes on as the war rages outside, and we're hearing today just how intimately connected all that is. The video feeding out of that chamber into a country still at war. Both of you have helped us understand the kind of dynamic inside and out, and we're grateful for that. George Packer, New Yorker magazine writer, author of The Assassin's Gate, America and Iraq. Always great talking with you. Thank you for being with us today.
My pleasure.
And Michael Scharf, professor of law at Case Western Reserve University, been intimately involved in all of this. Michael Scharf, thank you very much for being with us.
Thanks for including me.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
On Point is a production of WBUR Boston and NPR, National Public Radio.